This is CliffCentral.com.
All right. We're going to take the temperature up a little bit more. Muna and Manek with I Know a Place, CliffCentral.com. It's Thursday, which means it's time for the Burning Platform. The Burning Platform is brought to you by Nando's. It's your opportunity every week to check in with all the big stories, the stories that are causing all the news and all the noise. And we get to do this with Pumi Mashiro and with Canton Pele. And this morning, I'm sure there will be as much argument and debate as there was in the first hour of this morning's show, right?
Well, I don't know. It sounded to me like it's actually not going to be that much of a burning platform because you've got snowflakes in the house.
Oh, who are you talking about? Me?
Pumi.
Oh, Pumi.
Pumi.
Yeah.
Do you always have your hair tied back like that, or is that pony just for today's burning platform?
My hair still happens to be wet, but you're still welcome to come and check it out, you know?
Like Donald Trump made people touch his hair to make sure they couldn't pull it out.
Yes.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, the Burning Platform, this is your opportunity to find out what's really going on in the world. Let's start off with the thing that everybody is talking about, Eskom. Apparently, the big news yesterday was at a, public enterprises briefing. Eskom is technically insolvent, we know that, and will fail to exist at the current rate by April. Now, that's news. It will fail to exist. It will go out of business and out of action, which, of course, means that the whole country will be in darkness for the next 20 years. So what is this? Is this just a scare tactic? Was the load shedding as a result of a serious technical problem, or is it what Eskom has done before, trying to squeeze money out of us?
It's kind of difficult to actually nail down, because there are so many people who are telling us so many different things that are broken. I don't know if you guys have seen the pictures emerging of the interior of the Medupi power station being covered with ash.
No.
As a very specific example. So it's just one reason why Medupi's capacity has suddenly just gone completely offline. So its ability to contribute to the grid is no longer there, and we're effectively taken back to where we were before Medupi, a part of it actually came online.
Let's just remember, Kusile and Medupi are the most expensive power plants ever built in the world.
Started off with a budget of $80 billion, which was approved by the World Bank at the time, and then mushroomed to $200 billion. Now, let's not also forget that
That's 200%.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it went from.
How does something go? If you're going to make me a coffee and charge me R2 for it, and by the time I've turned around to pay you with money from my wallet, you've suddenly pushed the price up to R400.
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, you can factor in. Part of the reason, of course, was that when Zuma tanked the economy, you had depreciation of the rand, and based on the fact that a lot of the expenses that are involved in actually constructing power stations means that you're spending money outside the country. And if you do have the rand losing 50% of its value, which it did, then effectively your costs are going to end up doubling. So that's one piece of the puzzle, which is not to say that it's not Zuma's fault. It is Zuma's fault for tanking the economy. But if we take just that as one example, but let's actually just go back to the basics. When Medupi was actually built, Chancellor House had a stake in that contract because of what was essentially a corrupt deal with Hitachi.
You need to tell people what Chancellor House is.
Okay, Chancellor House is the investment wing of the African National Congress.
I'm just making sure people are informed, Canton. Don't take this for granted.
No, that's fair comment.
Chancellor
that's fair
House
comment.
Is the ANC's till.
Exactly. Well, it's one of the ANC's tools, because we now know that Bosasa was an ANC tool. The Guptas was an ANC tool. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the most fundamental ANC tool, Gareth, is you and me.
All right.
And not Pumi, because Pumi's a socialist.
All right. So let's just look at this quickly. The Public Enterprises Portfolio Committee yesterday said the company's debt now stands at $420 billion, which poses a significant risk to the economy. In his State of the Nation address last week, President Cyril Ramaphosa announced the entity is to be unbundled into three. And how do we feel about that? Do we have any opinion on this?
I think my opinion on it is that should have been done a long time ago. However, the unbundling is not the same as actually removing the sole point of inefficiency, which is the fact that Eskom is a monopoly. So just simply saying that I'm splitting my existing company into three companies, but I'm not going to change the ownership structure, isn't So effectively what it's doing is, from having a single point of theft, you're creating three separate potential points of theft.
You're trebling your ability to steal.
Now, but having said that, in principle, should we be splitting up ESCOM into those three categories? Absolutely. That should have been done a long time ago.
But you
need to split them up and then sell them off.
But shouldn't the priority be that we should allow the free market to allow ordinary power producers, whether they're big or small, to enter the market and participate? They could put some energy into the grid. They could provide at competitive prices. Why don't we do that? Do we have a problem with this?
Well,
is that not the most obvious way to solve the problem?
Look, a lot of us are already doing it. If you consider the number of people who are making a systematic effort to go off-grid. And right now, the amount of money that you need to invest to go off-grid for, let's say, I was looking at a calculation that was being done by one enterprising company in South Africa right now that's pushing a load shedding solution effectively for around about 53,000 rand.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, so 53,000 rand, basically what it gives you is about 5 hours of uninterrupted power based on...
which is stage banded.
On sustained consumption of roughly about 2 kilowatts. 2,000 per hour. So if you consider 53,000 rand, you know, end up multiplying that by four. So you go off grid for a quarter of a million rand, roughly. Completely off grid.
Well, I like that.
Yeah. So, and I think that lots of people are already in a position to be able to do that. So if you consider the average parliamentarian, for example, that ends up being about 2 months' salary for them?
I don't mean to be as socialist as Pumi, but it's always the poor that get screwed here because they can't afford to make that kind of investment to get themselves off the grid. They're totally dependent on power from Eskom, and they're not going to have a way out of this. And Pumi was saying earlier in Soweto, she was used to, as a kid, growing up with regular power outages that would sometimes last for weeks. And unfortunately, this is not going to
get clearly there. Grew up in the privileged part of Soweto because the Soweto that I remember didn't have electricity. Oh. You know, there was the particular smell of the townships that came from coal. Yeah.
Coal burning.
Yeah. And the kitchen used to be the center place of every home. You'd be huddled around that coal stove because it was the only source of warmth in the room.
Yeah.
In the entire house. But look, right now we've got, what is it, three separate commissions of inquiry going on into what's happening at Eskom.
But okay, so Pravin jumped in on Monday, and suddenly there was a reduction in the chaos and the hysteria. But I don't know that he solved anything. I mean, he's having talk shops, and of course the unions are not being particularly helpful here because they say, yes, Eskom's a disaster and it's management's fault. They're not wrong. That it is absolutely, this is about mismanagement and theft and corruption at the highest orders. So it's not the ordinary worker's fault. But the fact is that Eskom provides sheltered employment for far too many people, and some people will need to be fired.
Well, let's take a look at what's the outstanding money that Eskom actually needs to pay. What is the current debt sitting at?
$420 billion.
Yeah, $420 billion.
And remember, they cannot make enough money, even if everybody starts paying now, to cover their operating and debt service costs.
They'd never be able to. So that money is going to have to be written off.
How does that happen?
Well, how it happens is fundamentally because government stood as guarantor for a lot of that stuff. It means that ultimately the payback has to come from us as taxpayers.
So,
but you see, the more crucial question for me right now.
It's not a small amount of money, Canton.
No, it isn't.
Do we even have $420 billion if we all put our shoulders to the grindstone?
In other words, we need to add this to the close to $3 trillion that Jacob Zuma has accumulated during his wonderful 10 years.
So call it an even $3.5 trillion.
Yeah, okay. Call it an even. So when you look at it from that perspective, you know, just adding another, you know, a couple of hundred billion here to the almost $3 trillion that we've got already, it's much of a muchness. You know, you just push the knife in slightly deeper. The more crucial question that we're not asking at this point is, let's say we take that money we take the debt and we say this now becomes our responsibility as South Africans. Should we then be rebuilding Eskom?
No
we shouldn't. That's the point.
Dissolve it.
Yeah, so dissolve it. And I think the whole idea of making use of the distribution network as a separate entity, that makes a lot of...
And let private power distribute it and private power generators come in.
Yes. But well, if you consider the logistics now...
But the ANC's not going to do that. ANC don't want to give up on ESCOM.
Absolutely not, which is why we need to vote the bastards out.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that that's going to happen either.
But well, it's because we've got these idiots who keep insisting on saying that we need to give Ramaphosa a strong mandate. I mean, Thabo Mbeki, who you know, I'm an Mbeki fan, you know that. And Thabo Mbeki had the strongest possible mandate. He had a two-thirds majority in parliament, one of the most popular presidents. In fact, he was the most popular president this country.
More popular than anyone.
Yes, that this country had ever had. Mm-hmm. And the ANC ripped him out. Who's to say they won't do the same thing with Ramaphosa? I say they will.
Yeah. Okay,
the problem is that nobody else has a plan either. So even as we vote the ANC out, nobody else has a viable plan.
You're saying that the DA doesn't have a plan. No. Frankly, from my
EFF doesn't have a plan either.
Frankly, from my point of view, the EFF's plans make a lot more sense than what the ANC does.
Really? What are their plans?
Well, the EFF plan is to make everyone poor, which takes us back to ground zero.
Okay.
But at least it's a plan.
Okay.
I mean, even Terra does. Even Pope doesn't have a plan.
Well, I don't think he has a party, really. It's just really him. The problem here is also that people don't pay for electricity. Like, we don't pay for e-tolls. Like, there's a general civil disobedience going on. I mean, we talked about Soweto with 15 billion rand owing to Eskom. Now, municipalities all over the country owe them, I think, 30 billion rand. It's grown threefold since 2007. Sorry, that's their wage bill. That their wage bill is 30 billion rand. The municipal debt is something like 100 of the 420 billion. So if we're not going to pay for electricity, then it's partly our fault too. I mean, we're obviously...
But that's the reason why we need to shut down Eskom. Because you are never going to have a situation where the government is going to actually turn off power to people who are not paying. They will not do that. They don't have the guts
to turn off my power if I don't pay.
Yes, I know. But that's because...
They turn off my grandmother's power if she's not paying. My grandmother is paying for her power.
Yes, but that's because you happen to be a person... You're a ratepayer. You have a meter that goes directly to
your... Me and Pumi's gran, they know where we live.
Yes, they know where you live. But fundamentally, what it's all about is that government is very happy to wage a campaign against the intellectual capital of this country. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. We have doctors who have not been paid since January.
Yes, in state hospitals.
In state hospitals. But the nurses are getting paid. Why is that? Because the nurses are part of the ANC's power base, and if they go on strike, then the ANC is in trouble.
Well, people are going to die because doctors aren't being paid.
But since when does our government give a flying F about whether or not people are dying? I mean, we've seen Sedimeni
and Marikana. Yeah,
yes,
sure.
But consider the fact that when we had the last strike by health workers, when Helen Joseph Hospital was actually barricaded by striking nurses. Ambulances were not allowed to get in. People died as a result. How many people prosecuted?
Zero.
And what did Aaron Motsoaledi do? He went to a hospital in Pretoria and he said he's rolling up his shirt sleeves and working on the floor as a doctor in order to provide health care to people. But not one person was actually prosecuted. So when you are in a position to be able to steal with impunity, why on earth would you want to do the right thing and actually pay?
So, Canton, I know this is a little bit of a departure, but I think it's important. It's the one thing that when I was kind of thinking about this morning's show and the important things to touch on, I wanted to ask you about. I mean, SONA has come and gone, so there's no point in having, and it's been like debated like ad nauseum, including what was trending on Twitter last night. And you mentioned now Thabo Mbeki being one of the most popular presidents that we've ever had with a very strong mandate, which makes me think about the second leg in that TM triumvirate, right, of Thabo Mbeki, Tito Mboweni and Trevor Manuel, is looking forward to next week, is this? Tito's, our tweeting
yes,
finance minister's budget. I'm quite keen to hear, listening to the Sona speech and where we sit in a election year, what you think Tito is going to bring that is new, considering the Eskom debacle, considering the huge state debt that we have, and
good question.
The power base.
And he's hamstrung. He's he hasn't got a lot to play with, right?
The power base of the ANC and keeping them happy. What do you think Tito's going to bring us?
Well, I can tell you what he definitely will do. He's going to raise the tax on cigarettes and he's going to raise the tax on alcohol.
Standard.
Look, frankly, what we need to do at this point that's actually going to make sense is to increase VAT. We have to do that. We have an unsustainable situation right now where less than 5 million people are actually providing the income tax base that sustains this country. And that base has been eroding because we have people fleeing this country. And the reason why they are fleeing this country is because the law of diminishing returns has kicked in. So that means that the people who actually have the capacity to build the economy are leaving the economy. The people that are left behind have to make do with less. And right now, our ability to continue squeezing the people who are providing that income tax base has actually been pushed way beyond the limit. So the only way right now that we're going to be able to raise enough money to be able to meet this massive debt burden that we've got is to increase VAT. It has to happen. Do they have the guts to actually go out and do this? I doubt
it. Not in an election.
I doubt it.
Not a chance. So put me the question, it's very valid, because to your point, there's nowhere else for them to get money.
Yes.
We're not going to borrow from anybody because I don't think anyone's going to lend us any.
Or stimulate the economy by making business less cumbersome. So take away some of the,
we can't
take away some of the huge barriers.
We still haven't fixed this bloody visa issue.
Yeah. That small businesses have to.
We still have tourists being turned back because of the visa regime that was put in place by Gigaba. We can't even do that very basic thing.
I do want to refer to the Sona quickly. I do agree with Pumi also that it's been broken down and analyzed by everybody, the bright and the stupid, over the last couple of days. But I'm curious as to your reactions, both of you, to what the opposition parties said. They said Cyril Ramaphosa's comments on the current power crisis show he's not in charge of the country. He on Monday said he was angry. His comments came
shocked and angry. Shocked and angry.
And then someone joked that, Mr. Shocked President, you need to have electricity to be shocked. Dennis Blum from the Congress of the People says that Ramaphosa must stop undermining the intelligence of South Africans. But is he really? Because we've demonstrated an ability to be stupid and to be credulous beyond almost all expectations.
But what if we work on the assumption that our president is in fact clueless?
Is that what you're going to go with?
I'm happy to go with that. I think our president is clueless.
All right.
I saw a tweet yesterday.
Do you want to add something to that?
I saw a tweet yesterday. One of the many political analysts we have in this country tweeting at Cyril Ramaphosa, blink twice if you're being held against your will, because the ANC doesn't agree with anything that you're saying.
Seems like it, right?
It makes us think that he's being held hostage in that position. But
this is the stage of Stockholm syndrome that so many ANC supporters are in. Like, they love the ANC, but the ANC is actually holding them captive. I mean, ordinary voters. I'm talking about people who love the ANC because it liberated this country. But they just can't move away from the fact that they've actually got a gun to their throat. Stockholm syndrome. Classic Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, but it comes from an outdated belief system, you know, because your lived experience is actually more important than objective reality. Don't you know this?
But that is Pumi's argument from earlier.
It's not an argument. It's an absurdity.
No ways. If the lived experience, if and we deserve the government that we have, guys, because our lived experience is one that says this government hates us. Not this government does not care about us. This government hates us.
What is an unlived experience, if I might? Can I get clarity on this? What is an unlived experience? Guys, can we just go back to Eskom for a second, okay?
Sure.
Let's try and project what is the way in which this can actually play itself out going forward? Because I think that's the most crucial thing. Here's what I think is going to happen, and here's what I think is already starting to happen. You're going to increasingly have communities taking it upon themselves to bring in generation capacity. So, for example, it doesn't mean solar. Okay, what it means is that you actually invest in generator capacity, which is probably going to be diesel. Mm-hmm. It's going to particularly work in gated communities.
Sure.
Because the first thing that you'll do is you'll actually allocate a particular space. You put in place metering for every single property that's on the premises. You arrange for regular supplies of diesel to come in. And guess what? You're off grid. And right now, the price-performance ratio in terms of that is very cost-effective.
And it's way more cost-effective if you consider into the bargain that Eskom want to raise the price of electricity.
Exactly. And Eskom's going to have to just in right. order to, they're running to standstill.
So stop giving them your money.
Yeah. So that is the most basic point. You know, if you look in terms of if Eskom's going to be increasing their rates by, let's say, 6% every year for the next 20 years, and if you calculate your payback period based on that, then it actually makes a lot of sense right now to get to the point where you're putting in your own generator capacity. So I see that as the first thing that's going to happen. And so what does it mean is that everyone who doesn't go off grid is going to be left to actually pick up the slack in terms of paying Eskom. And eventually you'll get to the point where that system completely falls over and you'll the differences between the have and the have not is going to be who's got power and who doesn't.
Right. I do want to talk about Thabang Makwetla because Julius actually called him out during the State of the Nation address. It was the only moment that I saw that was, slightly reminiscent of the Zuma era where there were constant interruptions. Cyril mostly got through his speech without interruptions. Everybody was quite well behaved. No one needed to be taken out by the white shirts. Turned out one of the white shirts needed to be taken out by the EFF afterwards, but we'll leave that alone for the moment. Julius called out Thabang Makwetla in particular and said, why are you laughing when the president was talking about corruption? You're going to jail. That's what he said to him. So Deputy Minister of Justice and Correctional Services, he's Thabang Makwetla, is alleged to be one of the top government officials whose properties were installed with security systems free of charge by Bosasa. He says he will share his version of events at the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture. At least there's a voluntary, normally you have to do a lifestyle audit on people for them to come forward. But in this case, he's obviously either scared of something and wants to clear the slate, or he has nothing to hide. Let's take him at his word. Do we think that someone like him is just a sideshow? Mm-hmm. I mean, is this not the real story? Is this even worth paying attention to?
Well, the rot just runs so deep. It's like, you know, Gwede saying that he was not corrupt. And people keep asking, well, did you have a security system fitted at your house that you did not pay for?
I love the way these are people in the ruling party having security systems installed to protect them from the people they're governing.
Yes.
Mm. Only an unpopular government would ever prioritize that.
Yes. Yeah, but I mean, you know, that would never happen in Iran. Okay, it would happen in a place like the Netherlands, where you have the prime minister pitching up for work on a bicycle, but it would never happen in Iran.
Have you seen Donald Trump's security brigade?
Well, it's the same as any president of the United States since Kennedy was actually shot. I reckon that's a fair precedent for a president to go through.
But and this is the point, you see, my point being that if, again, you know, this is, you know, to just look at one particular aspect and not give everybody the same kind of view. African presidents and their brigades.
Yeah.
South American presidents and their brigades.
And ironically, most people couldn't be bothered to assassinate South Africa or African leaders because
it's so much easier to buy them.
Yeah, right. And get them to just be your slave. Really, I mean, that's slavery by another means. It's slavery by paycheck. Bosasa's Louis Vuitton bags.
Look, and I think the Thabang Makwetla thing must be Makwetla. And Bosasa and Julius, and this is the problem with an inquiry that's going to take as long as the state capture inquiry. Is the point of it is it's a big smoke and mirror distraction tactic. We're going to forget about it. We're going to, the news cycle is going to move on, and it's going to feel like something is being done, but nothing is being done. You know, it's just 3 years from now, we'll all be talked out, we'll be tired of hearing it, and we'll have forgotten. We'll have forgotten all of those things, you know, so...
Well, let's see where our National Director of Public Prosecutions actually takes.
Well, yeah, Shem, she's only just started. She's had 14 days in the job properly. She was sitting in the gallery in Parliament the other day during the State of the Nation address, and there was this very beautiful picture that was taken by one of the photojournalists of her sort of sitting there scribbling stuff down long after everyone else had left the gallery. She certainly seems, from what we're hearing, and particularly I hear the EFF getting very nervous about her, that she's a Pravin ally, which of course means that Pravin, who we know is having his problems with the EFF at the moment because the two of them are not seeing eye to eye, they're suing each other, in fact.
They've always had problems with each other.
But Julius is saying, oh no, Pravin can't be trusted, and she's one of his henchmen, which clearly means that between Pravin and her, they might have something on Julius. I mean, if you read between the lines.
Well, I wasn't aware that there was an established connection between her and Pravin.
He's trying to make that point.
Okay.
He's trying to make that case. Let's talk about a small party, the Freedom Front Plus. Okay, they say stop land expropriation without compensation. Peter Groenewald says Cyril must take responsibility for 9 wasted years, referring to former President Jacob Zuma's presidency. At a dinner at the World Economic Forum in Davos last month, Ramaphosa intimated that the country had lost almost a decade of growth. But responding to the State of the Nation address, Groenewald hit back saying Ramaphosa was complicit in those lost years. And he said, to grow the economy and create jobs, here's some advice. Stop expropriation without compensation. If you continue doing that, I can assure you the economy will start to grow.
But this is as obvious as the fact that we have noses on our face, surely. I mean, why are we still having this discussion?
You know, the thing about the expropriation
without compensation is theft.
Hold on.
It is legal theft.
We have in our constitution, section 25, which has a very clear law by general application of appropriation. The problem is that for the past year, the two parties that seem to care about redress have spent a year doing what politicians do, politricking us, right? This law exists from the get-go of the Constitution. It is Section 25. Any one of us can go and read it up. They spent a year debating this Section 25 instead of going, how is Section 25 going to be applied? So for me, it's disingenuous of the Freedom Front to say, stop this. It's been in our Constitution from the jump.
Well,
My
grandparents were expropriated from their, I mean, I've got 5 generations of my family buried on that land. They were expropriated by the nationalist government in the 1970s when they built the nuclear power plant at Pelindaba. And that's my family's land. There are bodies in the ground to prove it. And they were expropriated by the nationalist government under those same provisions which Pumi's talking about that already existed. And this idea, and they weren't compensated fairly for the land either, because the state needed it for their very big plans to build nuclear bombs and to power the country with nuclear energy, and none of that obviously materialized. The bombs did, but they were very quickly dematerialized. But this is not something new, and the state trying to gather for itself
but
more
Gareth,
powers.
You need to understand what is the basic agenda that we have here. The EFF is building a culture of hate in this country. And remember that this started with the EFF. And this is at the point at which I say that Ramaphosa is actually clueless. Because what should have happened at the point at which the EFF tabled this motion for expropriation without compensation? Ramaphosa should have turned around and said, we are the ANC, we are the ruling party, we will table a motion on expropriation without compensation, if necessary, when we are ready to do so. So you withdraw your motion, we are not going to pass it. Instead, he went with the flow because he thought that at the time this was going to win him some brownie points. And instead, he's got us into an absolute mess that he cannot now back out of. Meanwhile, the EFF is going down this path of insisting that we build this divided culture in this country. I have a clip that's now doing the rounds of Julius Malema claiming that Indian people do not marry African people because of the fact that they are racist. And you are looking at a man who actually negotiated lobola for his nephew. I was there when my nephew did the ritual slaughter in order to marry his sweetheart. And so it's clearly absurd. But Malema is pushing this agenda.
To be fair, Canton, that's just your lived experience.
I know. It's just my lived experience, you know. I
mean, but yeah, so Julius is actively
and in the case of the sheep, it wasn't.
You know, why does Julius get a free pass for being racist about Indians? But he gets a free pass for being racist about everyone. Cross about Adam Katsavelos and Penny Sparrow for good reason. But why does he get a free pass for being blatantly, openly racist about Indians? How does that happen?
Well, it happens primarily because white people are too scared to tackle him. That's the most basic question. I mean, if you look at all of the people who go on about white guilt on Twitter primarily, mm-hmm. you know, ask yourself how many of those would actually turn around and attack Julius. Not one of them would.
This is the moment of the drum roll, because
I have one.
What's
for you.
My favorite? Yes, please.
All right, here we go. You don't. You only need to ask me once, Pumi. I do. I kill for you. I kill the.
Dude, you have to do something. So when you are angry, and Camden's point that white people are too afraid to tackle him, do something. The outrage that we see is because people go, I'm not going to stand for that. Mm. And if we allow it, we give him a free pass. If we allow it, we give him a free pass. And that's the thing. You have got to do something. You have got to do something to change a particular thing.
I've seen a lot of journalists who are very much EFF admirers suddenly start to change their tune. I'm seeing more and more articles about how fascist the EFF are, and that's become almost a bit of a buzzword for them now. And I'm seeing lots of public commentators starting to say this stuff. But who else needs to join this discussion, Canton? And how can we start to roll back on this huge liberty we've given Julius to be as racist as he likes?
Well, the only people who can really do something about this is the president himself, really. It starts with him.
I mean, if we've locked people away for being in contravention of various codes that we've decided as a society we've adopted, that we don't tolerate racism and so on. And there have been people who've gone to jail. Surely,
and you know what the EFF
there's
does.
A plan that can be put into place.
It always fascinates me when they call everybody, right, and they go down to what's the police station in Hillbrow?
Yes.
They go down to the Hillbrow police station and they start
lay
a case.
They lay a charge.
And this for me is always so fascinating.
Well,
when
Praveen
they do
laid
that.
A charge against it.
And yeah. You see, and this is the thing for me is that they are very good. They're very good at branding themselves in a particular way. They're very good at communicating what they are doing all the time. And they're very good at taking opportunities. They will always strike. They will strike. When there are students fighting for whatever reason, they show up. When there is a community that is, they show up. And that showing up.
But
I
frankly,
in terms of who
is actually doing something right now, shout out to AfriForum.
Hmm.
Seriously.
They do show up.
AfriForum are the only people who consistently will do the principled stuff, and they act on behalf of anyone who actually goes to them and say, give me help.
Yeah, they did. They went
and,
out.
And, but of course, Pumi,
not on behalf of anyone.
Actually,
on behalf of their...
Really? The woman who was being beaten up by Grace Mugabe?
Or that guy in Tshwane. There was a black
anyone.
Farmer in Tshwane who had his land invaded.
Yes, but...
A little while ago.
Yeah.
And you see, for me, the thing, and remember we spoke about this with AfriForum, and I said what I find absolutely admirable in what they do is they have gone and they have said these are the constructs within which we have to operate in order to make this successful. I mean, it's one of the ways that at the very beginning of our democracy, the parliamentarians and the ANC, the NP guys ran rings around them because they understood the process, and they just followed the process. They were methodical in the way that they followed that process and held the accountability and kept pressing on that thing. And that's what we all have to do as South Africans, is we all have to understand. We have to understand what levers and mechanisms we have at our disposal, and we have to push on those. We have to press on those and press hard.
What are those levers and mechanisms, Pumi? Let's hear them.
The law.
Yeah.
The law.
You know, some of these laws are actually... So, going back to what we were talking about Julius just now.
Yeah.
You know, the whole idea that Julius should be going to jail for stuff that he says, I disagree with that. And because my problem is that, you know, the likes of Adam Katsavelos and Penny Sparrow and so forth.
And that other woman who was rude to that cop.
Yeah, whatever. You know, they're an absurd bunch of racists, but, you know, I don't care. You know, the stuff that you are saying to me, whatever Pumi's lived experience, you know, it's like water off a duck's back for me. You know, call me whatever you want to, but if
I'm paying for electricity provided.
Exactly, yes.
And if you're doing things to me, that's different.
Correct.
Words are not violence.
Yes, words are not violence.
Well, we've got an interesting guest coming in. I think you guys will be interested in hearing from Devon Moonsami later on, the CEO of the ICHAF Training Institute. He's written a recent article called Racism and Sexism Are Offensive, So What? I think you might be interested in what Devon has to say. Devon Moonsami, that's after 8 o'clock this morning. But back to our discussion. So we've talked a little bit about Julius. We've talked a little bit about of Cyril's huge quandary at the moment. What about because we have to refer to the DA occasionally, even though it pains us to do so. I see they're tearing themselves apart at the moment over affirmative action. I mean, I thought this was established fact and that it was done. What is the DA's position on affirmative action? Why is Phumzile Van Dam saying that Eskom failing is somehow about black people failing and that this is racism again? I mean, who are these people and what's going on in the DA?
Well, you should really ask a DA voter. I'm not one of them.
Neither am I.
Yes.
I'm trying to find one. Pumi, do you know any?
Well, even within the DA, it's hard for them to find one.
I think the DA is in for a huge hiding in this election. Huge hiding. And they deserve it. I see Soli Mukwa...
Mapaila.
No. Tswane.
Mwing.
No,
Msimanga.
There's so many Solis in this country. And they're all problematic.
Soli Msimanga, the former mayor of Tswane, who's now running for premier of Gauteng against David Makura, has left his job as mayor of Tswane now, and he's joined the provincial legislature. I mean, this is a big play by them. They obviously think he's got quite a lot of political capital from his term as mayor of Tswane, and that'll help him be elected as premier of the province. But what really are the chances for the DA at provincial level in Gauteng? I mean, certainly in the Western Cape, they've also got their work cut out for them there, thanks to Patricia leaving and various other factors, not least of which the fact that the incumbent is sometimes hugely unpopular within her own party, Helen Zille. But what is Sully's? What do you think the chances are for Sully in Gauteng against David Makura?
The DA is eating itself up from the inside.
But the question of what his chances are, do I believe that there's a possibility that they will increase their base in Gauteng? I think there is. But do I believe that's going to be enough to push them over 50%? The answer is no, which means that you're back to the whole idea of having coalition politics. And that's going to have to be with the EFF again.
Mm.
So... And
the EFF were cordial enough to say to the new mayor of Tswane that they will give him about 3 months, they said. To prove that he can do his job. But I mean, you see that they're in an interesting position because this, when people talk about how minority parties don't matter, they really do.
Yes.
And even the smallest of parties can have a very decisive look at what happened in the Eastern Cape in Nelson Mandela Bay. If that coalition of small parties hadn't helped to oust Ethel Trollope, they would never have got it right, the EFF on their own. And so what's happened there is that they've proven again...
Well, EFF. Let's not forget Bantu Holomisa's role in that.
Bantu Holomisa, yes. Sure.
Who's another interesting one, because...
It's not as honourable and noble as everybody always says, because he's also an opportunist, like all politicians. So, to my point, the EFF get to decide They forced the ANC to adopt policies last year that the ANC wasn't necessarily in favor of, because they're outflanking them always to the left.
Except the ANC was not forced. The ANC was tricked. The DA has been forced. For example, one of the first things that Herman Mashaba did when he became mayor was to close down all the bike lanes. Now, bike lanes are a good thing, guys. You know, can we just agree upon this? That, you know, it actually creates relative degrees of safety. So,
particularly people alive.
If you look in terms of the CBD as a classic example for the student population that's going to Wits and UJ and so forth, bicycles would actually be perfect for them for most of the year in terms of cost of transport and so forth. But effectively what you're doing is forcing them to hop onto taxis and spend their money, and it was a bad idea. But because Julius said we are not going to do this cycle thing because it's a white privilege thing, that's one of the first things that Mashaba killed, even though it made absolutely no sense, because it was part of the deal.
Hmm. Guys, please, we have very few minutes left, and I cannot walk out of here today without having heard your opinions on the most interesting thing to come out of yesterday's SONA debate, and the sellout comments.
What were the sellout comments? Just remind me.
So, Legota's big comment and accusation.
That's right. He said that Cyril's a sellout.
That Cyril sold not just a sellout, but particularly sold him out. And the ensuing debate with him and Aaron Motsoaledi. I mean, he was livid on that podium. He was almost in tears, almost the same level of tears we saw when he was at the land... land hearings. He was shuddering, and he was so passionate about how he had been sold out, and that is his big pièce de résistance of why Cyril Ramaphosa is a mess and should never be listened to and followed.
So is he saying Cyril sold out in terms of
sold him out to the SB?
Well,
so
it wasn't just him. It was that entire Black Consciousness group at the time. Essentially, what he said was that they were all in custody, and Cyril then essentially wrote a letter to the security branch saying that these guys had filled his brain with communist ideas.
And that's why that's how Terra ended up in Robben Island.
I'm paraphrasing. I'm sure you can pull up the clip.
I didn't realize that Terra and Cyril have had this long...
Well, I didn't either. And consider that I've known Terra since he came off the island in 1982. You know, I've known Terra that long. And Terra, of course, was accused number three, as I recall, in the Sasso BPC trial, which emerged out of the Frelimo rally that took place in Durban. So
Frelimo celebration.
Yeah, so I think Sats Cooper was accused number one in that, and Terra was accused number three in that, and of course all of them ended up going to Robben Island. Mm. Yes, and so I didn't know that Ramaphosa actually had any sort of schooling in Black Consciousness back then. It would make sense given his age. But
what does it do to Cyril's struggle credentials and credibility in the movement? Because ideology is a massive part of what makes the ANC work. And if you're not a true believer, in inverted commas, then it does affect your position. Is this Terra just unburdening himself of something that clearly Pumi says he was emotional about for a long time? Or is it something more insidious? Is this about, look, Cyril's really not a man of principle in any way, shape, or form?
I don't know where it's going to lead to. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the questions that people have been asking is, you know, is this true or not? And that, of course, from Pumi's point of view, there's no such thing as truth. So, so clearly, it's his lived experience.
Yeah, because Cyril's going to come back and say it's not true. The SB lied about a lot of people. That's what Aaron Motsoaledi said.
Yes, and it's true. The security branch did lie about lots of people, but
I've been watching this show called designated survivor. And the scripting is, after episode 3, the scripting really takes a dive because it becomes all this shit about refugees and, you know, sanctuary cities and stuff. But the premise is this, that in America, during the State of the Union speech, one of the Congress people is taken away to an undisclosed location in case something terrible happens. Because you've got all three branches of government there. You've got the executive, you've got the judiciary, and you've got the legislature. And in this TV series, they all get wiped out by a massive bomb in the Capitol. And this guy is the only survivor, and he has to take over as president. Right? He's sworn in that night. And the way we're talking about our government, and I don't want to border on sedition or treason in any way here, but the way we're talking about our government now, it just seems to me there are so few good people. It would almost be a blessing if we had a designated survivor situation, because it seems to me that everyone's so enmeshed in some dodgy stuff that's in there. They all have such dark pasts, and there are so many people of questionable morality and questionable networks that I really, like, part of watching this show for me is a bit of a fantasy. It's like, well, what would it be like? And let's not just think about what it would be like in America.
Who would be the designated?
But, like, imagine in this country, imagine if our designated survivor was someone like Buisen Ntlozi or Batabile Dlamini or, you know, Musi Maimane. I mean, God forbid, but let's imagine any of those three. What kind of a world would we live in? And what would our government do? Would we be able to handle? The biggest test of any government is when really predatory, dangerous, international terror strikes. Or even an invasion by a foreign country. That's always when a government's really tested. And this government's never had tests of that capacity. They've been basically put in charge of a peaceful, mostly peaceful country, where things, you know, if you do a little maintenance here and there, you can kind of keep the wheels turning. They've done legitimate harm to the peaceful country in terms of what's happened in the last 10 years. We've degraded and not maintained absolutely anything. And what's happened as a result is that we're now in a position where we're extremely vulnerable. And I watched the show, and I mean, I know it's fantasy and it's made up, but if we did have a massive existential threat right now, I don't know that anything would hold. I don't know that if we were invaded by, for God's sake, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, whether we'd be able to, honest to God.
You know, the Zimbabwean army have a thing. The
Zimbabwe would take us out.
The generals in Zimbabwe say they would eat breakfast in Harare and they would eat lunch in Pretoria. They would just mow over.
Now, we're sitting here squabbling, but I think it's worth a government, and we don't have an intelligence service to speak of. It was really an information gathering service for Jacob Zuma while he was president. Do we have anyone paying attention to these levers of power, these massive influences on our very sovereignty? You know, because we talk about how Venezuela has descended into chaos, for example, and how America's perched.
You know, are we vigilant?
A lot of leftists are saying America's perched to take control now of the Venezuelan oil, because they see international relations as being so one-dimensional. But if we were, now we've discovered oil, right?
Yeah, sort of.
Let's just think about this. I mean, I always like to leave the burning platform on a cliffhanger. We've discovered oil.
I see what you did there.
Any comments on that before we wrap it up?
On the discovery of oil?
No, on our ability to protect our own sovereignty.
I think sovereignty is overrated.
Oh, really?
Yes. I mean, if you consider that there are many parts of the world, Somalia being a case in point, most of Nigeria, where, you know, there are no-go areas for significant chunks of the populace, and still they actually get by. You know, fundamentally what happens is that you'll end up with these increasingly gated communities that are spreading around the world, not just, and this is something that's very much the case in first world countries as well. You know, if you look at the American South, where Trump wants to build the wall, the people who are protesting about building a wall are people who live in those gated communities. So they don't really care, because the barbarians are the gates, but the gates are there, you know, because the gates are in the wall. So they'll be safe. We're very much doing the same sort of thing out here right now. If you look in terms of places like Waterfall, you look in terms of places like Steyn City, you go to Century City in Cape Town.
They're autonomous collectives, essentially. Yes,
effectively. And they're quite able to function. If you look in terms of the stuff that you actually need to still continue to be productive with the rest of the world, if you're in the knowledge economy, which a lot of people are in this country right now, then effectively all you need is internet connectivity. And increasingly you're not relying on government to be providing you with that internet connectivity. So as long as you have a means of exchange, which might not necessarily be the rand for much longer, but as long as you have a means of exchange and,
Gareth has Bitcoin.
And you're able to pay people, then yeah.
All right.
We must be vigilant and we must guard our freedoms, guys. We cannot leave it just to the politicians. For me, it's the way that I live my everyday life is to say how can I, in my small community, how can I make my life and those around me better? Because if we do not do that, in those gated communities, why you need the gated community is to keep the poor people out, is to keep the have-nots out, and there are so many more of them, they will eat.
It's a zombie apocalypse.
Favorite billboard from Occupy Wall Street: the poor will eat the rich if we don't do something about the inequality.
Not in this country. The poor are so abused and downtrodden they don't even know how to stand up for themselves
eat
anymore.
Eat the rich.
And the politicians lead them by the nose. And poor people in this country can be bought. You saw there was an EFF protest not so long ago. And the guy, it was some situation with a union, I don't know, but the EFF pitched up and then they were going to trash the store and the guy just bought them all KFC and everybody went home. That is the South Africa we're dealing with. You can cow people, you can get them to chill if you just like give them a warm meal. It's that sad for ordinary people in this country who are struggling. They're not willing to pick up the cudgels and the pickaxes and the pitchforks.
Gareth, that's exactly my point. If he had not had that warm meal, he would have been their lunch.
There's something to think about. All right, thank you, Pumi. Thank you, Canton. That's the Burning Platform for this morning. It's brought to you by Nando's. On the way, we're going to speak to Devin Munsami, and we're going to talk about an article that he just wrote called Racism and Sexism Are Offensive, So What? We'll find out. Very controversial. All of that and more on the way for you.
This is CliffCentral.com.